Welcome to the National Campaign to Restore Civil Rights interview series, a regular examination of the court cases that shape and affect our lives.
It is often the case that those lawsuits that get the least publicity have the most potential for changing our legal system. At the moment, there is a case pending in the Supreme Court that could have a significant effect on our access to justice. Known as AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, the lawsuit has to do with arbitration clauses that endanger established consumer and civil rights protections. To learn more about this case, we spoke with Suzette Malveau, Associate Professor of Law at Catholic University of America. What is the AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion case about? What happened in this case?
What happened in this case is you have an arbitration agreement where, you know, people are supposed to arbitrate any kind of disputes that they have in the future. And in that arbitration agreement, it said that you could not have a class action. And the California court decided that that arbitration agreement was unconscionable. It was not enforceable. So what's before the Supreme Court is this question about whether that California court decision, is it allowed? Is it preempted by the Federal Arbitration Act? And so I know that that's a kind of a sort of technical, but what happened here is very simple. You had the two people, the Concepcions, they decided to get cell phone service from AT&T Mobility in response to an advertisement. And so they went out, they purchased a phone, and when they purchased the phone, they were promised a free phone in addition to the purchase phone. Turns out that the phone was not free. AT&T had charged them for the phone along with sales tax. And so when the Concepcions decided to, they signed a service agreement for the cell phone service, that agreement had an arbitration clause in it. And that basically means that they agreed if there were any disputes with AT&T in the future that they weren't allowed to resolve those problems in court, they had to resolve them in arbitration. And so this agreement, the arbitration clause, not only did it say you have to go to arbitration, but it also said if you're going to challenge any practices by AT&T, you cannot bring a class action. You have to bring your own individual case. So the Concepcions decided, you know, they did challenge the issue with the free phone here. They basically said that they had misrepresented that this phone was free and that this was a violation of California's consumer protection laws, that this was sort of fraudulently or charging them a phone or misrepresenting that this was free to them. So the Concepcions tried to bring a class action in the federal court in California on behalf of themselves and all of the AT&T consumers that were in the same boat. Now, the arbitration agreement had been revised, you know, throughout this time period, and the arbitration agreement included a lot of what would be considered kind of consumer-friendly provisions, things that would be good for consumers. But it turned out that the trial court, the federal court in California, said that this arbitration agreement was unconscionable, right? That it was not enforceable because of California state law had certain requirements that said that this was not an enforceable agreement. This went up to the appellate court, the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit also agreed that, you know, under California state law, that this agreement was unconscionable or unenforceable, and that the Federal Arbitration Act didn't, in fact, preempt California's decision, this court decision, from being able to go forward. So AT&T decided to see if the Supreme Court would hear the case, and the Supreme Court agreed that it would hear this case.
How did the lower courts rule?
What happened here is we know that the trial court said that the arbitration agreement was unconscionable under California's state law, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed that decision and also agreed that under California state law that this agreement was unconscionable and therefore unenforceable. And that the California court had the right to do this. It was not preempted by the federal law, the Federal Arbitration Act, which deals with arbitration. And then we know that the Supreme Court has now decided to take a look at that case and, in fact, has already heard oral argument to see which of the parties is correct. So it's a really important case to be discussing. We've got consumers, we've got businesses, practitioners, scholars, people all over the country that are paying attention to this case because of the tremendous impact that this can have on class actions and on the enforcement of consumer laws.
What were the arguments made?
Well, basically, on the one hand, you have AT&T is taking the position that the Federal Arbitration Act preempts this California court decision, right, and says that this ban on class actions or this class action waiver, that it should not be unconscionable and unenforceable, and that the case should be resolved in arbitration and it should just be an individual case. We know the Concepcion's take the position that California, the state of California, has a right to hold under its state law that a class action ban is not permissible, is unconscionable under its state law, and that this case should be resolved as a class action and it can take place in arbitration. So the big argument here between the parties was whether or not California courts, are they discriminating against arbitration agreements? Are they somehow treating arbitration agreements differently or worse off than other kinds of contracts? Because if that was the case, that would be considered a violation of Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act, because the Federal Arbitration Act says that arbitration agreements are on the same footing as all contracts. They're to be treated equally. And the Concepcion's are arguing that California is not targeting arbitration agreements. What they're doing is they're targeting all contracts that basically immunize the defendants from complying with state consumer laws. The Concepcion's are very concerned that if you don't have a class action, if you're not allowed to bring your case as a class action, then it's going to be really difficult to enforce California's consumer protection laws. And that this approach is not just being targeted to arbitration agreements, but any agreement that would basically allow the defendants to get off the hook in some way and not have to comply with the California's consumer laws. AT&T, on the other hand, is arguing that as a matter of federal law, arbitration agreements should be enforced unless they're invalid in some way under state law. And they're arguing that California, in fact, is discriminating against arbitration agreements, that they're being treated in a more harsh manner than other types of contracts, and in a variety of ways that these arbitration agreements are, in fact, being a disadvantage, and that that's not fair.
Why are class actions important?
Excellent question. Class actions are, and I think this really goes to the nub of what's going on here, are very important because it creates an incentive for people who have very small claims. Like consumers often have small claims here. You're talking about a free phone and, you know, charges, sales tax on that free phone. So not a lot of money is at stake. So people who have these small claims don't have the incentive to, in fact, challenge wrongdoing. And so a class action creates an incentive for people who have small claims to come together and to challenge wrongdoing, systemic practices. And it gives lawyers incentive, in fact, to bring those cases. And so a class action is a tool that really enables individuals to challenge systemic wrongdoing in a way that, you know, individual cases are not going to be able to do that. And often even federal government agencies, when they try, you know, they try to address wrongdoing, may not have the kinds of funding, may not have the sort of, you know, may have, there's a lot of bureaucracy and sort of the capacity to enforce some of the consumer protection laws and even some of the civil rights laws that we think of in a way that is aggressive. And so consumers are really relied upon to function as private attorneys general to bring some of these cases to make sure that the consumer laws are enforced, You know, it's certainly, if you have a class action, you're able to challenge systemic discrimination. You're putting everybody else on notice that, hey, there may be some deceptive practice out there that you need to be aware of that, you know, most consumers would not be aware of if there wasn't a notice given through the class action. And so the class action really does tend to deter wrongdoing. So, you know, I think businesses and companies are very, very mindful of the power of a class action. And so when you have these small cases, you know, there's sort of, there's strength in numbers, and those little cases get added up together and can be a very powerful force in terms of enforcing the law. And I will add that class actions are very efficient. So if you think about, you know, each individual bringing their own separate case over and over and over again, you have the same issues coming up, the same, you know, they have the same interests, that's very inefficient use of the court's time and money and really everybody's. And so it makes sense to take all of these cases, put them together, and to make a class action, and so that they really can, there is strength in numbers, and you can sort of overcome what might be a divide and conquer kind of strategy on the other hand. And that, you know, that is, and that's really what was at the heart of this case, because you know, the Concepcion's are arguing if you forbid class action, or, you know, then you're not going to have that effective, you're not going to have that effective enforcement tool. And the state of California was very concerned that under certain circumstances, if you have, you know, a contract of adhesion, meaning, you know, it's a take it or leave it agreement, and it involves really small claims like we're talking about here, and you have an allegation where there's a party with greater bargaining power that's trying to deliberately cheat lots of individual consumers who have small claims, that all of those things together really make it so that the company, the defendant, can escape liability, right? And that can be exempt from the consumer laws, because under those circumstances, it makes it incredibly difficult to challenge systemic misconduct.
There have been other cases in recent years in which the Supreme Court has ruled that the courts should enforce mandatory arbitration clauses. Why should we care about mandatory arbitration? What effect does this stance have on our access to justice?
Mandatory arbitration, I think what's really important to pay attention to about mandatory arbitration is this notion of consent, right? When we think about mandatory arbitration, is fine if it comes out of, you know, it's really the product of two people sitting together, knowing what they're getting into. It's a consensual agreement between the parties, right? Because arbitration can have a lot of positives. And so, you know, the Supreme Court has deferred to the enforcement of arbitration agreements within a certain context. And it made sense before because the Supreme Court's deference to those arbitration agreements comes out of, you know, you have a union and you have an employer, and they together sit down and hammer out problems, they work out issues through arbitration. And so in the collective bargaining context, it certainly makes sense that you would have mandatory arbitration. And so that's where the Supreme Court's deference came from, because you really had two sophisticated equal players, repeat players that were hammering out, negotiating in the context of arbitration. Now, sort of fast forward, and what's happened is the problem is you no longer have, you have arbitration that is, mandatory arbitration has expanded to cover lots of types of contracts that deal with people of unequal bargaining power. So let's say you have a consumer or you have an employee on the one hand versus, you know, their employer or some big company on the other. And so it's almost sort of a David versus Goliath kind of situation. And now the mandatory arbitration, you sign an agreement and it says that, you know, if you want this cell phone, if you want this bank account, if you want this job, then you are going to agree to go into arbitration if you have a dispute in the future. And, you know, I mean, quite honestly, nobody is really in a position to negotiate, well, let me cross out that arbitration clause, or no, I don't think so, well, let me cross out that ban on class actions. Nobody is in a position really to bargain or negotiate. It is, you know, presented to the regular consumer, the regular sort of employee, everyday person, hey, this is a take it or leave it situation, right? You either agree to this or you don't get the job, right? Or you don't get the cell phone or whatever else it is. And so it's not, unfortunately, I think what's happening is, this notion of consent negotiation that really starts to fall apart when you look at those mandatory arbitration agreements in some of these contracts where there really is unequal bargaining power. I think in terms of access to justice, there are the explosion of mandatory arbitration agreements does have an impact on people's ability to access access to justice. On the one hand, I will say there are good features. There can be good features about arbitration, right? Which is why you want it to be consensual and we want it to be available if it's truly, really embraced. So you think about arbitration can be, can be less expensive and it can be faster, can be more convenient and flexible way of resolving problems. And so you have that on the one hand. But on the other hand, I think people need to be aware of some of the pitfalls of arbitration, not be sort of forced to go into something without really having their eyes open. So when we think about some of the downsides of arbitration, you have very limited review of an arbitrator's decision. There's limited discovery in terms of being able to get access to information. There's no jury trial. It can, in fact, turn out to be expensive if you're paying for the arbitrator's time and you're paying for the fees and the things like that. There's no written record often. The arbitrator doesn't have to follow precedents, doesn't have to follow sort of binding law. It may have limited remedies. It may be confidential. I mean, there are a lot of things that provisions, and of course, there may be no class actions. And so there are a lot of things in arbitration that, in fact, can be barriers to relief or barriers to what we think of as sort of access to justice that people need to be aware of and really do need to give up those sorts of rights, knowing and understanding the impact of that.
What is at stake in this particular case?
There are sort of two ways of looking at it. I mean, depending on who wins, there's a lot that is a lot that's going on. A lot of people are focused on what might happen as a result. So, for example, if it turns out that AT&T wins, then the question becomes, are businesses going to rush to insert in their arbitration agreements a ban on class actions, right? That this you can put that in your arbitration agreement, and if that is what happens, the real concern is that this is going to eliminate class actions, or eliminate class actions certainly for consumer claims that deal with small amounts of money, and that's a problem here because of what we were talking about before in terms of jeopardizing the enforcement of consumer laws. That is so important to be able to have a class action when you're talking about these small amounts of money, so that you can get systemic change. It's really the only way consumers can do that is to push that systemic change, which is brought about through the class action mechanism. Because individual lawsuits, sort of, each one by one by one by one, is not going to do it. And government, government agencies may, in fact, not be able to play that greater role. They can play a role, but there's a role that the citizen has to play in terms of law enforcement here. And that we have found that, that is very critical in terms of countering systemic discrimination. And so that's the problem. And we may see legislation that will come out of it if AT&T wins. There's the Arbitration Fairness Act of 2009. In fact, may get some more support for it and start pushing that legislation again to say that these kinds of mandatory arbitration agreements that are not permitted, right, in certain types of arrangements. If you're talking about civil rights cases or consumer cases, that may not be permitted. So we might see some legislative pushback if the court goes in that direction. On the other hand, if the Concepcion's win here, The argument by businesses is that they're going to walk away from arbitration entirely, altogether, because it's that really this may be the end of arbitration in California or other states where, you know, it's a lose-lose proposition for businesses, because class actions are so risky that businesses would be afraid to be exposed to class action. So if they can't have an arbitration agreement that excludes class actions or prohibits class actions, they're not going to have arbitration at all. And so that's because the, you know, if a business gets stuck with a class action and arbitration, unfortunately, they're not in a position, there's no meaningful review of that decision. So it's just way too risky. It's a lose-lose proposition for those businesses. So this, the concern on their part is that this is really going to discourage, if not kill, arbitration in certain states because of the way that state law looks at unconscionability and tries to figure out whether or not the arbitration agreement is enforceable. So this is it's considered a consumer-friendly arbitration clause, and if this consumer-friendly arbitration clause doesn't survive, then the thinking is, well, what will? And so I think a lot of businesses will actually be running from arbitration, which is exactly what the Federal Arbitration Act is supposed to avoid.
This case was heard in the Supreme Court last month. What were your impressions of the arguments?
I think it was very interesting. I mean, I think that there is a real tension that the court is dealing with, and probably that tension may exist more for the conservative justices than the others, which is, you know, states' rights on the one hand versus business rights on the other, or business interests on the other. And this seems to be somewhat of a tension, because I think the court was really wrestling with, this is state law, this is California's state, the courts in California, federal and state courts in California, they have a right to their contract law, right? If they say that here are the three things that we find that make a contract unconscionable, then the Supreme Court is thinking, who are we to tell them otherwise, right? Who are we to dictate to the states what their contract law should be? And so I think they really have some concern there. Where's the line? And they don't want to cross the line there, because that's not what the Supreme Court is in the business of doing, right? To start micromanaging the states and telling them what their state laws should or should not be. So it's one thing to disagree with the state of California, or really any other state. There are about 20 states, in fact, who have found these class action bans in arbitration agreements unenforceable. So I think there's a concern that the Supreme Court doesn't want to tell those states what their law should be. So that's certainly something that I saw coming out of the argument. I think another interesting issue that came out of the argument there was what's the boundary line? What can states sort of control in terms of arbitration? What is arbitration, right? Is it okay to not allow class actions? Is it okay not to allow a jury trial? At what point do we start forcing arbitration really to look just like litigation, just like the legal system? Because these are two different systems, and you should be able to choose to go to arbitration because it has all these different features that you might like over other features. And so to what degree are we sort of imposing on people's ability to freely contract with one another and, in fact, to embrace a form that looks very different than the court system? And then finally, I think one of the interesting issues that came up in the argument was this whole issue of discrimination and whether or not the courts, the state law coming out of California discriminates against arbitration agreements. Well, it doesn't say on its face that it discriminates. In fact, it says, you know, we have the same rule across the board for litigation and arbitration. We want to make sure defendants are not, you know, escaping the consumer protection laws. But if there is something that's neutral but has an impact that is negative on arbitration, then is that discrimination? And how can the Supreme Court tell, right, when that discrimination exists if it's not obvious? So I think that was an interesting debate and issue that was going on. So really, really tough issues before the Supreme Court, and it's going to make a big difference in terms of class actions in the future.
Great. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you.
That was Suzette Malveaux, Associate Professor of Law at Catholic University of America.
The National Campaign to Restore Civil Rights is a collection of more than 100 civil rights organizations and numerous individuals who came together to ensure the courts protect and preserve justice, fairness, and opportunity for everyone. The campaign focuses on public education and outreach, finding ways to get the message out about the impact of court rulings on our communities, our opportunities, and our rights.